So first, what I'm not going to talk about, I'm always interested in charged polymers. I'm doing some simulations of Omar Saleh's pulling of single DNA. That's really just ongoing. Then there's some work that's recently published on neurofilaments. And I will talk about some other stuff in the membrane discussion, but one of the other areas is membrane fusion, which really is the biopolymers, and therefore I'm not really talking about it. So I'm going to talk about this work that we've been slowly doing on microtubules. And just to refresh memory about what microtubules are and kind of what's special about them. So it's a tubular structure. The monomer is a dimer of tubulin, alpha and beta. And there's a polar ends to it, and that it polymerizes in a particular direction. It's a strongly charged polymer. The binding involves between the monomer, it binds actually with GTP, and then it goes to GTP, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in the next slide. Sort of some details, 13 monomers in a turn, roughly. And then one of the key aspects is that it polymerizes, and then it can catastrophically depolymerize. And this is used in the cells to basically kind of do a random shooting and finding how to, where it's going to make a track, or where it's going to go from one point to the other. It doesn't really know where it's going. It just tries, and if it doesn't hit something that stabilizes its end, then it depolymerizes and tries again. And what actually is not on here is also very important. These are the tracks that the kinesin motor protein and also the dyne walk on.
Can you remind me of the scale of sizes?
So one of these is about 4 nanometers. And the diameter is 24 nanometers. So, and let me go to the next slide to say, so part of this growth, initially they bind with GTP, and the traditional picture has been this, where this is a whole section that's converted from GTP to the diphosphate. The growing part has the GTP, and as long as it has this cap, it can keep growing. If it loses that cap, what happens is you get these GTP filaments that bend, and it's unstable, and it shrinks. And the perspective is that the difference between GTP and GTP is that you got a bend in that dimer that produces a mechanical instability. The picture is evolving, particularly over the last few years, because of the new experiments. All this data is kind of electron micrograph. Newer data, which has been using optical methods to, there's a bead out here that's measuring the change in growth, and they can do that down to about the size of an individual dimer. And so now a picture is more like this. So, it's not a uniform cap. It's not just growing nice and smoothly at the edges and things of that sort. But I mean, overall, one can actually say that there's a lot of missing pieces in the experimental data in terms of describing what's going on there. So I'm actually in a project where what we want to do is make artificial microtubules. So what that is we don't have to use tubules. We can use anything we want. And that then begs the question, well, you want to have, some at least subset, ideally trying to produce all of it is going to be complicated. But if you want to have a monomer and, a glue particle that's going to act as the GTP, what properties are they going to have? And of course, a lot of these are going to be the same questions you'd ask if, how does microtubules assemble? And one of which is, what's going to be the features in the monomer? Where are their interactions going to be? What do you have to do to get actually a tubular structure? What causes the depolymerization, or how do you design something that will allow you to depolymerize. We're happy, and I'm not really going to go into this, we're happy if the depolymerization can be due to an external agent. Use light or something that breaks bonds. And most of what I'm going to be talking about is a model where just the difference between the lateral and the longitudinal interaction strengths is what we're investigating. Charges, I think, play a big role as well, but that's just not where we're at the moment. So what I've done is taken some inspiration from some work that was done on assembly of capsids. So there's this nice work of Dennis Rappaport a few years ago, where he uses what I call a cheese wedge, because it's yellow and everyone knows in the United States cheese is yellow, with interaction sites. So the yellow particles are actually just
purely repulsive with excluded volume.
All the attraction is at these sites. And using this shape, he can self-assemble into these T1 type capsids. One of the things that is not surprising is that you, as I call it, the Goldilocks, you have to get the bonding strength to be right. If it's too weak, you don't get assembly. If it's too strong, you get a lot of partial assemblies that can't equilibrate into the full capsid. So in fact, for his parameter range, it was a very narrow range. And then the PRL was actually talking about that if you put explicit solvent in, that helps kind of lubricate the interactions, helps really the reversibility, and that really promotes assembly. So what I'm going to do is ignore this important lesson because it's very expensive. I'll probably get away with it a little bit better simply because the capsid is a harder geometry to assemble in than a tubular. But I think the lesson still is there. So what I do is I have a slightly different wedge geometry that's set up so that you go into a ring with interaction sites on the lateral and in the longitudinal directions. The different colors indicate that they're different interactions. So in this I've set it up, yes. So the red likes the red and the blue likes the blue, but they don't like each other. And that's so that you don't get the symmetric interaction, which will foul things up. You have to break all the symmetries. And it's designed so it's going to be 13 just by the geometry.
Green and blue then?
And the green and the blue like the green and the blue. So the green is is attractive interaction to a green site on the bottom. Likewise, well, this is cyan. And they're repulsive to site interactions. So if you're actually making the system, these could be some acid-base pairs. That's one of the things they're trying to do. And then
the other ones.
And the gray particles is just a purely repulsive.
Yeah.
Do you break the plus minus N symmetry?
So there's no polar aspect to this. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. There's nothing. There's not. That's not
actually
it.
Actually, some kind of Lennard-Jones.
What I actually did is I just used this soft potential, because originally what I wanted to with this we can have well depth and you can vary this cutoff, so I could vary the range.
This is KT.
Yeah. These are units of KT.
Yeah.
As it happens, and this one here is the size of those gray beads, which are Lennard-Jones. As it happens, I have not varied this range. I've just varied
this interaction strength.
And these are kind of the better parameters that I found.
So what happens at the point?
Where?
R equals zero, so I mean, there's no requirement.
This is just the attractive part. So there's a Lennard-Jones purely repulsive on the... And the thing that you have to think about is a little bit different. I now have a composite particle. So these interaction sites are out here. So it's not like there's an R to the 12th that goes like this. The R to the 12th comes in a little bit over there. So there's various things where, you know, my intuition is all based on particle simulations. I now have a rigid body, one of which is I got 6 degrees of freedom, so the basic entropy that I'm fighting against is 3 kT, not 1 or half. So that actually gets into just the basics of how strong the interaction has to be. It has to be greater than 3 before you get any substantial, you know, dimers or anything of that sort. And you reproduce what you basically would expect. If it gets too strong, you get lots of assembly, you use up all the monomers very quickly, but, you know, it's not any structure that you're interested in. It's kind of in this regime. So, in fact, there's two things going on here, which I should say. So this is if I keep the lateral and the vertical interaction strengths to be the same. But one of the things I started noticing is that when you get all these filaments growing, it's very hard to get anything that will form a complete even ring. So we started favoring the interactions that are in the lateral that would form ring growth over an interaction strength that promotes the filament.
So you're in the diffusion control regime.
Yeah. So, in fact, one of the other aspects is, you know, the density that we have, it's a dilute density, but, you know, compared to a biological, it's highly concentrated just because we don't want to let things diffuse too slowly. We need the monomers to diffuse fast enough just so we can do it. And so this is a system with 5,000 of the wedge particles. And these are the lateral and the vertical interaction strengths. And it shows, you know, you can get all kinds of structures at this stage, which is pretty late in the simulation. There are a few monomers. There's a lot of tubular structures. And one of the things I wasn't expecting, this one I think is one of the more clear, it's not a ring structure, it's a helical structure.
But in the biological system, the microtubules are not created from the solution or the brine. So this is not necessarily a process which is relevant to biological.
Right. I mean,
no, they're made by growth.
Yeah.
If you don't have a solution where there is a self-assembly.
Yeah. Usually they're.
You grow them. And you retry them.
Yeah. Usually there's a starting point where they grow from. It could involve gamma tubulin or other things. And in fact, we've done a little bit of that where we just put rings in at the initial state, which of course helps things. And if we wanted to do more of trying to model what's going on biologically, that'd be one of the things that we would do.
Do you have possibility of coalescence at all?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, I'll show you an example of that. So there's some helical. It turns out when I just look at the energies between the helical state and the full ring state, they're less than KT. So it's not really a big surprise. It just that's what happens in terms of the parameter strain. So although part of what's happening, so this is one example of going all the way to the initial form of a helical turn. There's like two layers of the wedge that had formed, you know, 52 frames, which is some number of steps into this simulation. And then this is actually a dimer that was floating around and binds here. And then it forms a full ring at this stage. And, you know, the interaction strength is such that things, you know, they're bound, but they'll wiggle around. And in fact, this bond breaks. And it slides down here to form the helix. So, you know, back to there was a little bit of a discussion at one point about the, you know, free energy pathways. This is
a non-simple path, and it can be more complicated, as you were getting at.
Here's one of the helices where a sphere is a wedge. Here I'm showing the actual individual wedge, and this is at a given state in the simulation. And all these individual wedge particles come together and form that one. And there's primarily these two big fragments which are shown here. I made one a little bit darker gray than the other. And this is non-helical here. It's due to the fact that these two merge, and you know, at this here you can also see this is straight and flat, and what happens is as they merge and heal, you now have a zigzag, and it's in this healing process that it shifts over to being helical.
If you start with the helical seed, does it heal to become cylindrical, or does it will it continue?
No, it'll stay as
helical.
So you have started with the seed.
Yeah.
Which hour, which what configuration is the lower energy?
I think it's the ring.
I guess it depends on the parameters, because right, the helix will have a, if you cut it, it will have higher contact area, right?
Yeah, I have to double check.
No, kinetics.
Yeah, you know, my presumption was that it was the ring one, and so when I did the calculation, I had to double check to make sure that.
Mark, you get only small this size. I mean, because
sort
of your end energy is huge, I think.
We'll go back.
So it's surprising that.
I mean, this is where it's dependent upon a bunch of parameters. One of which is how long I run.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
is there a way to cap it? Can it cap?
So no.
To lower the edge?
No, there's always going to be an edge.
There is no. Okay. Yeah, but just, I mean, you can say if
you could
cut it in the middle, you create the. So yeah. You pay this as the energy.
The system could lower its end energy by going up to one tubule. So
then for example, I don't understand.
And that would presumably happen if you run long enough. And that's orders of magnitude. I mean, this is one of the difficulties is just be able to get to this stage. I'm running really long.
It's a general
not big simulation.
If you want to have very long ones, you need to make a nucleation rate. So he has a relatively high nucleation rate, so he has many nuclei. If you make nucleation rate low, you get very, very long microphone.
Yeah, but can you get the two come together like Mike's scheme of
card?
The green and the.
Right, yeah. So it's this collisional dynamics.
They
could do it, yeah. And in fact, you know, what this
thing
shows here is that, you know, fragments will do it, so. And in fact, one of the things we want to do, because people. This issue has come up in experiments with microtubules, and they can dye them, you know, red and green. And they've now done that where they take fragments and say, well, will they merge? They do. So the real microtubules will merge. And we haven't done it, but we'll do a simulation where I take, you know, things of this size, and I'll probably help them out by aligning them a little bit, that sort of thing. And they should merge. So one of the things that I think has some biological significance is we're finding that, you know, the picture has been that the filaments want to grow in microtubules. But when we make the interaction strength such that it prefers to form the filament over the ring, it's hard to form tubular structures. Now, again, this is without a seeded growth, and that would be one of the things that is on my list to look at. So this is a similar simulation to the other big picture, but in fact the interaction strengths are just switched. And you get a lot of fragments that are longer in the filament direction, but the only one that actually curls around is this one, and this one is actually, it's a 10 filament. In the helical return, which is not, of course, the 13 ideal value. And that's just, you know, because it's gotten enough of a width that it can curve and bend itself and heal that surface. And it goes ahead and does it. So, you know, there's this question in my mind in terms of the actual biological microtubules. Which is basically, if it really does prefer this kind of filament, how does it do it in such a way that it can control the growth without getting more distorted structures, kind of that I'm seeing here. Now, part of that would be the nucleation seeds. Part of it also is interactions that I'm not including.
Is there any indication that in experimental situations, diffusion control has a reaction control? Because I think in diffusion control, you would have rough structures.
Yeah, well,
this nature. What are the parameters?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I can argue parts of it both ways. So, because some of it is diffusion, because you know, it's a diffusion of the monomers, and that's part of this whole polymerization, depolymerization. When it after depolymerization, it does again. It's got to get those monomers to diffuse back.
Just by looking at the structure, it looks more like equilibrium than a lake. So it must be reaction control.
Yeah.
I mean, do you have any barriers to your reaction in your case?
No, because it's just not
here. Yeah. That's an issue.
Now, so actually, let me just. I'm going to skip and just go to this because I think this is actually the other aspect that, which we haven't treated, is electrostatic interactions. These are strongly charged individual monomers, and that then would include some. It goes both ways. I mean, it can be a barrier. Or because you have to also realize that GTP is, a multivalent ion. You get subtraction that's mediated by the multivalent ion. And they also have, I didn't write it down here, there's strong dipolar moments in each of the directions. So that can help the individual monomers to align as they come together, and particularly then when you have a whole tubule, whatever its field. So I suspect that there's a whole electrostatic aspect that helps do some of the.
In particular, there's a switch. I mean, once you attach the same monomer, so you have hydrolysis, and the GTP goes to GTP, and actually that changes the charge as well.
Yeah.
So, but you don't have that, and then so you
no,
like
no.
It's just like.
Yeah.
You put that in artificially so that once you absorb something, that you change something.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things I'm interested in doing, and I think it's from the simulation point of view is very interesting. Having a small molecule come to really this rigid body, and A, it's going to bind, and it may deform this too. And so you have to come up with various schemes. And again, if you think of it in terms of charges and the repulsive attraction, because you have to have both. I think it can be done, and that, of course, applies to not just this problem, but a lot of other problems in the binding of a protein and its deformation. So, I've kind of gone over basically everything that I wanted to go over. Just maybe I'll end. So this is where we're starting to kind of boast some analytic calculation, as well as seeing where the simulations of kind of a generic phase diagram
and find kind of, from the practical point of view, where is the sweet spot in terms of getting the assembly of the tubular structures as opposed to the various other things.
So this is kinetics picture diagram or
dynamic
diagram? Because dynamically, don't you get a single tubular diagram?
It'll depend upon the interaction strength. In some cases, you know, at the weaker interaction strengths, you're not going to get full tubes. You can that is next.
So, thank you.
Motor active gels, and I will concentrate on some problem that mentioned this problem in the famous effective temperature discussion, and this problem of motor stiffening. And I hope that I will convince you that this problem may be connected to the criticality of the network. So again, this problem was motivated by active gels, and active gels are gels of actin with molecular motors and ATP. And these molecular motors, typically what they do is they introduce some contractile forces between points in the gel, and in addition to the myosin motors, there are crosslinks, rigid crosslinks between the actin filaments, such that this network has a finite shear modulus even without myosin motors. But what people have shown recently is that if you have such a network and you increase the concentration of myosins, you can increase the stiffness of the network by two orders of magnitude, and this phenomenon is called by stiffening induced by motor activity. So this is the first motivation for this work, and about the second motivation I will talk in a couple of slides. So in addition to the experimental work, some numerical work was done by brothers and McIntosh a couple of years ago, and they modeled this situation of active network by this simple model, a minimalistic model of some random network, and they modeled the activity of motors by force dipoles that introduce contractile force on some randomly chosen points in the network, and they have shown that you can at least qualitatively explain the stiffening of the elastic modulus. And what they have shown is that the most important parameter that you can describe everything using it is some average motor induced stress which is defined as the concentration of motors multiplied by the force that each motor produces. So you don't need to go.
What is L0?
L0, this is a lattice spacing on this network, just the length scale, microscopical length scale of the network. So motivated also by this result, I tried to understand analytically, theoretically, this strain stiffening phenomena, and to do so, I need to model first the network and the motor activity. So first, my model for the network is very simple. It's a minimalistic model of a disordered spring network. I ignore bending and many possibly other important things. So it's just a disordered spring network with some rest length L0 between of every bond, every spring. And for example, you can think the simplest possible case of such a disordered network is a diluted regular network. For example, here you can see the diluted triangular lattice where each bond is present with probability p and is cut with probability 1 minus p, such that the spring constant has a binomial distribution of 1 and 0. And here it's known that the most important parameter in such kind of network is the mean coordination number, which is given by the maximal coordination number, Z0, multiplied by the probability that a bond is present. So for example, in this case, it's given by 6p. And the motor activity, again, motivated by this numerical result, I model by some average stress that motor produce. And by doing this, they change the rest length of spring by some factors that I define as 1 plus epsilon. In a moment, I will show why it's useful. So the motor activity is modeled by this parameter epsilon, and the motor activity is just reduction of the rest length by factor 1 plus epsilon.
Time dependent?
Yeah, all this is no, without any time dependence. It's just
reduction by
Because it's a contractile force typically that they produce. So by contractile force, they reduce the rest length.
Because the acting boxes.
Yeah.
And what is the boundary? So this is without any boundary
condition? Periodic boundary condition.
Periodic.
Yeah.
So it's again
a
stretched network?
Sorry?
Is it a stretched network?
I will stretch it in a minute, yeah. But for now, initially it's not a stretched network without any internal stresses. Internal stresses are produced by the molecular motor.
So this is, there's no stiffness, it's just elastic network, or is there?
Elastic network, yeah, this stiffness.
And so, if there's no stress, what controls it from collapsing?
Right. Well, it has L0.
No, zero. Yeah.
So, T equals zero without motor rest, and all the
sorry, T is temperature or time?
Time. So, all the springs are in equilibrium.
Yeah.
So, there's no stress.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, it's time doesn't play. You know. And so why I call this epsilon, because actually if you reduce the rest length up to the simple rescaling of length, it's this motor activity is actually equivalent to just global strain epsilon that acts on the network. I mean, global strain is just if the system size is L, so if you increase the system size by factor 1 plus epsilon and you fix the rest length of the bonds up to rescaling of the length, these two are equivalent. So that's why I call the motor, that's why I characterize the motor activity by epsilon, because you can actually connect these problems of global strain and motor activity within this approximation.
But the boundary condition, because without the boundary condition, the whole thing should fall on one ring.
It's periodic.
Or you put periodic boundary
condition. Periodic or fixed, yeah. And why is this global strain is, sorry? Yeah.
But you assume an affinity.
No, I don't assume any affinity. I assume uniform motor activity, and uniform motor activity, if it's uniform, is equivalent to the global strain.
Yes.
So I assume I find motor activity, but not I find deformation. And why the this global strain is also an interesting problem? Because similar stiffening phenomena people saw if they take actually almost any biopolymer network and they stretch it, so they observed similar stiffening behavior as stiffening under the motor activity conditions. So, for example, in all these experiments on of, collagen, fibrin, whatever, if you apply a strain, significant strain on the system, it typically stiffens. So that's why I think these two problems are connected.
How is it that each bond becomes shorter, but the whole thing becomes larger?
You have two possibilities. You can think about such that each bond becomes shorter and the size of the system is fixed, and then you have stiffening. You can think about the second possibility. You keep the rest length of each bond, but you increase the size of the system. After rescaling, it's the same thing, and that's why I think these two problems are connected. So this is my model. And now, first, let's see that this model, at least on the level of numerical results, gives what we want. So here you can see the network, initial network, triangular diluted network, as a function of applied strain. Here you can see the stiffness. So first you can see that indeed below some strain the stiffness is very low, actually in this case it's zero, and as you approach some critical strain it stiffens.
How close it was in the beginning to the percolation threshold?
The percolation, you mean the conductivity percolation or the elastic percolation? So in this case the coordination, mean coordination number is 3. I will show you in a minute that this is below the rigidity percolation threshold. So this, of course, is below the rigidity percolation threshold because you see that in the small strain limit, the stiffness is very low. It's zero.
It's about the obviously.
Yeah. So here you can see that you can obtain, this strain is epsilon, actually. So you can obtain strain stiffening by increasing this epsilon. So you can think about it. You can stiffen the network or by stretching it or by introducing motors which reduce the rest length of a bond.
So
there
is no temperature. So
this, no temperature.
So this epsilon is applied to every bond, right? So the only randomness in the problem is in the network.
So you can think, again, if you think about stretching, epsilon is applied to the boundaries. You stretch the network from the boundaries, yeah. If you think about motors, epsilon is just some average motor activity that on average is applied to
this epsilon. Is unidirectional stretching or?
This is uniform strain in any direction. This is
uniform, so both directions.
Both directions, yeah. And in 3D, three directions.
But is it the reason, the question is the reasonable description? Because the way I think about it is, I don't know much about stuff, but more of some random places.
And, exactly. So my hypothesis is that they will introduce some average stress that you can describe in these terms.
Okay.
And
mean field.
Yeah, it's more like mean field.
So it seems like you have really some bonds which are enormously stretched. So any, I would say, unless it's really a flexible polymer between these nodes that has a lot of length, this will somehow stop or be broken.
Absolutely. So for example, in the case of actin, we know that the elasticity of actin is highly nonlinear. It's entropic elasticity, it has some entropic slack, and if you pull more than this slack, you have enormous increasing of the string constant of this actin. So right, so for high strain, I expect to see in real system some additional nonlinear effect due to the nonlinearity of the single filaments. But the initial stiffening occurs, I think, because of this effect. So I would expect in real system to see this jump and then the second jump due to the nonlinearity of single fibers. Okay? So this is, I would say, conceptual proof at least that this model, this minimalistic model, gives what we want to see. And if you plot the stiffness of the material, in this case bulk modulus as a function of strain, you can see that for different values of mean coordination number, you see or don't see this stiffening phenomena. So here you can see that for two-dimensional systems, the critical coordination number is 4. Above 4, you see the finite stiffness in the low strain regime, and below z equal 4, you have some critical strain above which the system stiffens.
What happens if you compress it?
It's a very good question. I have an answer, but if you it compressed, I will show you in a minute what happens. You have some also very interesting effects. Okay, so you can do the same analysis for d equals 3. The critical mean coordination number is 6, so I will, you can do some phase diagram. So two-dimensional phase diagram of the mean coordination number and the applied strain, and these curves separate the floppy regime from the rigid regime. Above this curve in 3D, the system here is rigid, and below is floppy. This is a phase diagram of this minimalistic system. And as you apply strain, you actually can cross this curve, and the system stiffens. Regarding your question, here you see that this left panel describes what happens at negative strains. So negative strains are responsible. It's like compressing the system, and you see that the mean coordination number, the threshold, actually increased. So if you have, for example, finite elasticity at linear strain, but you compress the system significantly, you can lose the elasticity even if you have it in the linear strain. Okay, so this is the numerical result. So first, let's explain this numerical result, because we want to understand analytically this system. So first, let's understand it on the qualitative level. Why do we have this stiffening? So we know that in the linear elasticity regime, there is a so-called Maxwell argument that gives that the mean coordination number has to be larger than 2D to have a finite rigidity in the linear regime.
You used 15.
Sorry?
You have used 15.
Really? So I will run. Sorry. In the conductivity regime, the threshold is given by 2. And why I'm talking to you about the conductivity threshold if the topic is elasticity? Because in the infinite strain regime, the conductivity threshold becomes the elasticity threshold. If you have connected cluster and you stretch a system a lot, it becomes rigid at the end. So that from the interpolation between these two, you can build schematically a phase diagram, and here you see that this is a zero strain limit. You have 2D Maxwell threshold. In the infinite strain limit, you have 2, and you can draw some schematic lines that connect these two points, and this is the stiffening. This arrow actually gives you the stiffening, because as you applied epsilon for Z between 2D and 2, you can obtain a significant stiffening from the floppy phase to the rigid one. Okay, so now this is the qualitative picture. Now let's understand this quantitatively. So quantitatively, in the small linear regime, in the small strain regime, in the linear regime, the elasticity of such a disordered network was described in the effective medium theory a long time ago by Torp and the company. And the main idea of this effective medium theory is to mimic the original disordered network by the regular one with some effective spring constant, alpha effective, and the self-consistency requirement of the effective medium that gives you this effective medium spring constant is that if you take this effective medium spring constant, alpha effective, and you replace it by the real one with the appropriate distribution, with the real distribution of the original spring constant, on average, the displacement of this bond due to this replacement of the spring constant has to vanish. Okay, this is a self-consistency requirement of the effective medium theory. It's similar to the mean field Ising model, for example. So if you apply it, you can describe the elasticity in the linear regime. So now the question is, can we take stretched system or system under the motor activity and apply the same idea and try to mimic this stretched system by the stretched effective medium? This is the idea, and this works actually show that it's possible. And if you do this, you try to mimic the expanded system by the expanded effective medium, and you apply the same idea of the self-consistency, you require this, basically the same as in the linear theory. This is the result of the that you get. This is a bulk model, this is a function of the applied strain or applied motor activity and the mean coordination number. So this is the result. So now from this result you can find phase diagram, you can find everything. So now if you look on the numerical results that I have shown you before and you apply this effective medium theory, you see that it works pretty well, both for phase diagram, for...
Do adjustable parameters?
No feeding parameters. Everything.
That must be because you're far from the preparation threshold, because
exactly.
Even the primitive effective medium...
You are absolutely true. Close to the... If you zoom on the rigidity percolation point, of course, like most of the effective medium and mean field theories, this all this breaks down. And actually, it's a different story. I zoomed on this. Here, for example, you can see, because of this jump, that maybe it looks like first-order transition and not second-order transition, also in this case. So it's a different story. What is the order of this transition? What are the exponents? Do they agree with the mean field exponents or not? It's a different story. I would be glad to tell you about it. But you are right. Far from the critical point, in the bulk, in the non-critical regime, all this theory describes well the system and also predicts the phase diagram pretty well. So just to summarize this part, that I think that motor stiffening and also strain stiffening phenomena may be understood in these terms. At least this is maybe the good minimalistic model for these processes. And this minimalistic model may be well understood quantitatively and qualitatively without any fitting parameters in terms of the effective medium theory in the nonlinear region. So that's all. Thank you.
Questions?
Okay. Okay. It seems to be actually the same that I was talking about yesterday, the same disapproximations, but the only difference is that you should replace, you're replacing temperature by stretches.
Sorry, what was yesterday? I missed.
Okay, then
you missed that
Yeah, the second one, the Indian. Yeah, I missed it.
Okay.
So, we don't really have motor protein activity. You replace motor protein by stretching, right?
Yes.
Is it obvious that that is the same?
It's not obvious at all, but in the numerical work that it was shown that the disorder in the location of these force dipoles, it's not very important for the elastic parameters. So
have you checked that if you, instead of a uniform, if you put these things and you make them stretch for a certain period and then turn it off?
You mean that the temporal dependence, the finite processivity. No, this I didn't check. It includes a more sophisticated model because you need to take care of temporal.
I'm talking about the question about your model and calculation model. Does your model have a threshold?
Of course, and
that's
this is a threshold, and this threshold moves this function.
But
of
this threshold is designed to be correct. Or it is?
No,
it is not. Is it correct threshold?
Correct for what?
I don't know. So if you do percolative thinking, will we get the same threshold or not? It's not clear.
In this system, this in the linear regime. In the limit of zero strain, we know the threshold for the mean coordination number. It's four, it's twice the dimension of the
effective medium. Effective medium gives correct threshold?
Here you can see. This is a comparison between the numerical and the analytical.
Indices, right?
Sorry?
But indices are not reliable.
indices, yeah, it seems like that the critical exponents are the same, and maybe even the transition order has some subtleties.
Not the same as percolation.
Not as same as the conductivity percolation. Yes, not the same.
For all those who don't know me yet, my name is Felix Illmeyer. I'm a PhD student of Ronald Metz, and today I want to present you one of my recent projects, which is about entropy convergence of hydrophobic hydration. But before I start with that, I just want to briefly introduce you to two other projects I've been doing in my PhD, just to give you kind of a teaser, and if you're interested, I'm happy to discuss with you at any time. So my work is based on atomistic molecular dynamic simulations using simple point charge water models, such as the SPCE model. So here you have electrostatic interactions due to partial charges on the atoms, which enables the water to form hydrogen bonds. Also you have Lennard-Jones interactions. And what we then do in a simulation, we just integrate Newton's equations, which gives us the time evolution of our system, like you see here in this example movie, and then of course from that we can get all the properties we want, like look at the track one molecule or look at hydrogen bonds and so on. As a short example how well these models work, I want to show you this graph from a project we recently finished. So here we calculated the very low Q region of the static structure factor for several different water models and compared it to experimental data from small angle X-ray scattering. And indeed, you see for all of these models, there's a quite good agreement between the simulation results and the experimental data, which is quite remarkable since, I mean, if you look at the scale, I mean, these are very subtle things. It's even more remarkable that even such features like this small minimum, which is seen in the experimental data, is also reproduced correctly by these water models, which is quite important since there has been quite a controversy about this minimum and how it can be interpreted. And so it's important to see that these water models are able to reproduce this. And that's
about the electric constant 81.
Sorry?
How about the electric constant of water? We produce 80.
It depends on the water model. For SPC, for example, we have 70, so it's quite good, but not perfect.
There's a universal relation between S of Q and the dielectric constant, right?
No, compressibility.
Compressibility. Ah. Yes, I mean that's what you see here in the zero Q limit, and that's the compressibility, and that works perfectly.
You're calculating the density, not the charge.
Yes, density. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry. So I mean that's all about this project. So if you're interested, I mean just approach me. So the second project I just want to shortly introduce is that one that's about the shape and size dependence of hydrophobic hydration free energies. So what we did here, we calculated solvation free energies for hydrophobic spheres and cylinders, and then tried to fit them by such interfacial models like the Tolman expression or the Helfrich expression. And the quite surprising thing we found here is that if you plot the solvation free energy per area as a function of the curvature, then you get this maximum, which basically means that the Tolman length, which is the coefficient of the first order curvature correction for the water, is negative. And this can be interpreted such as water prefers to form droplets to forming bubbles. So I mean, this gives you an Since it's a first order curvature correction, gives you an asymmetry in the direction of the curvature. And
but can you distinguish the linear order between the toe band and the head fish? I mean, so what, in terms of extension of one of the eyes, it's the same.
Sure. I mean, that's, I mean, the hair freak, we just go to one higher order. Yes, I mean, that's,
I mean,
not...
Look at the bending energy as an expansion of the tension.
Sure, sure. I mean, that's an expansion. I mean, the thing is, we cannot go far enough to low curvatures, so we really come to the linear regime. So what we do, we fit with the hair freak, and from that we get out then the linear term. And
so by droplets to bubbles, you mean that the water prefers to be inside, if you want?
Yes, that's the thing. Yes. So, also that's all I want to say about this project, so...
But you know that if you make a micro-emulsion, you take oil and water mixture, you get oil inwards and not the other way around.
Okay, I mean, if you have... Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated matter, so, I mean, if you want to discuss about this, I don't want to spend so much time here, since I want to go to the main topic of my talk, which is about entropy convergence in hydrophobic hydration, and I'll just give you a short introduction, so... It basically all starts with the question of protein stability, which is, of course, governed by the free energy change between the folded or upon unfolding, the free energy difference between the unfolded and the folded state of a protein. And if we assume that the heat capacity difference between these two states is constant with temperature, then from basic thermodynamic relations, we can write down simple expressions for this temperature dependence. And typically, the free energy curve for a protein then looks like this, where we have here zero crossing, that's the temperature of the hot denaturation, and possibly another crossing, which would be a cold denaturation, which also has been seen. And all these quantities can be measured experimentally, for example, by microcalorimetry. And people have done this for a long time. And the amazing thing they initially observed, you can see in this graph. So here we plot the entropy of unfolding of several proteins extrapolated to higher temperatures by these relations I've shown you before. And what you can see that they all seem to intersect at a temperature of about 112 degrees centigrade. And that's basically what is called entropy convergence, that the entropies converge at this temperature. The similar thing has been seen for the entropy of dissolution of several nonpolar substances. And this is shown here in a slightly different way. Let me explain this kind of graph, which is called NPG graph. So here we plot the entropy change as a function of the heat capacity change. So each dot here is one substance, basically. And in such a plot, you can see the convergence if all the dots for different substances of one series lie on a straight line. And it's easy to see if you look at this formula. Suppose we have such a convergence, meaning that at some temperature, Ts prime, the entropies of the solution for all the compounds is delta S prime, then if you plot this delta S versus delta Cp, this gives a straight line, and the other way around, if these dots lie on a straight line, then we have entropy convergence, and we can read off the convergence temperature basically from the slope of the line. So the substances that are plotted here are all hydrophobic liquids. These are hydrocarbon chains, alkanes, hydrocarbon gases, rare gases, and solid cyclic dipeptides. And here's also plotted the line for the proteins. And as you see, the slope of all these lines seems to be quite similar, which means that the convergence temperature for these substances is also similar. And
where are the alkanes? Is down there?
These are liquid alkanes, and these are some gases.
It's dissolution in water.
Dissolution in water, yes. It's all in water. And okay, what was followed from this similar convergence temperature for different hydrophobic substances was, of course, that this convergence is due to the exposure of the hydrophobic substance, or in case of the proteins, the hydrophobic residues, to the water. And what that basically means, that there should be a kind of universal temperature dependence of hydrophobic hydration, which is manifested in these equal convergence temperatures. And this has then been used to separate the contributions of the hydrophobic effect to the solvation, to the unfolding free energy of proteins, from which was then followed that the. Yes, I mean here this protein or this dotted line are the proteins from the first plot. So since the slope is similar, that means it has the same temperature. And yes, that has then been used to argue that the hydrophobic contribution is dominant for the protein stability. There have also been theoretical works on this, of course, so I only show you one example here. That's work of Gerhard Hummer. And what they did, they calculated solvation-free energies for hard spheres as a generic model for a hydrophobic particle. And what they got out was indeed that if you look at these solvation entropies, they intersect at one temperature, which is at about 400 K. So this is quite close to the experimentally observed value. And so this seems to confirm the whole story. But it's not as easy as it seems. So here again, I show you the initial protein data of Privolov, and even back then, when they first formulated this idea of the entropy convergence, there were some data points which weren't so nicely on this line, but they obviously neglected this in their analysis. And now, since then, there have been measurements for lots of more proteins, and if you include now a larger set of proteins, then there is no convergence anymore. So the question is, how can we explain this? Or, since the theories before confirmed this, and why don't we see a convergence here? And so that's basically where my work starts. So as I said before, people use
15.
Yes, I have three more slides. As I said before, people have used hard sphere models to model hydrophobic particles, but of course a hydrophobic residue is not a hard sphere, it has some smooth interaction. So what we did, we looked on how do these convergence temperatures depend on features of the potential, such as the stiffness for purely repulsive potential or depth and range of an attractive interaction. So we modeled particles with these interactions and calculated solvation-free energies from MD simulations. And what we get out is this. So let's first look what happens if we just vary the stiffness of a purely repulsive potential. Here you see the free energies. And as you can see for the entropies, if you increase the stiffness, the entropies are shifted quite a bit. And if you now, Hummer, look at solutes of different size, then you see for the same value of the stiffness, there is still some convergence. They still intersect at one point. But if you increase the stiffness, then the convergence temperature is shifted to higher values. So in principle, there's no universality. Even by just varying the stiffness, we can vary the convergence temperature over a long range. And all these particles are perfectly hydrophobic. These are repulsive interactions. So there doesn't seem to be any universality here. The same thing happens if we add attractive interactions. Again, if we increase the depth of the attractive potential, then we shift the entropies. And this, again, produces a shift in the convergence temperatures. Surprisingly, if you increase the range of the interaction, there is no shift in the convergence temperatures. So this suggests that this is mostly has to do with the first solvation shell around the solute. And then if we have a longer tail here, then this doesn't make a big difference. So let me summarize this. I've shown you that this initially claimed convergence only holds for quite limited set of proteins, and if you take a larger set into account, then you don't see convergence anymore. And this can be easily understood from our results, since the convergence temperatures we see depend subtly on the details of the interaction potential, and of course in protein where you have quite different residues, they presumably have also quite different interactions with the water, which can fully explain this. What I haven't told you, that this also depends on the quantitatively on the water model you're using, but qualitatively, I mean, this is quite robust. So this universal convergence, as claimed initially, does not hold. I mean, of course, you can still see convergence for like a homologous series of alkanes. I mean, since here you have only a different number of the same building blocks, and of course, I mean, these have the same interactions with the water. So here it still holds. Also for the rare gases, you could imagine that interactions might be similar, and there's also restricted convergence there. So that's it, basically. So thank you for your attention.
So, well, people will ask questions. I have to say that we have to violate our original order, because some people cannot do it on the other day, and therefore we'll do my case, and they were keeping now, and then we'll see how we are doing in terms of time, and we'll have similar session tomorrow, tomorrow, so we have to have three. Okay, so, question?
I will be doing it today. I'm not ready, and I have to leave the room.
Okay. So you are in good position. Okay, so any questions for you?
So tomorrow we're not having this session?
Yes. Apparently we do. Okay, so Mike.
If there are any more questions, I'm here till the beginning of July. So you can just come to me. In our simulations, so I didn't put this there because of a short time. Yeah, I can show you the data if you want.
Okay. No biopolymers, but there is soft matter physics and there is biology of a sort. Okay, so I'm going to say a bit about pattern formation in colonies of bacteria, and I'll do that by talking a bit about how bacteria move, which is a kind of interesting process because it looks like diffusion, but it doesn't have detailed balance. Because of that, those of us who have strong training in always thinking about reversible systems primarily, there's some unintuitive things that happen. So I'll say a bit about run-tumble swimmers, a bit about how they interact, in particular this case of a swim speed which depends on the density. And then I will link that to the fact that bacteria can breed and divide and die off. And that combination, I will hope to convince you, has something to do with so-called chemotactic patterns in bacterial colonies. So that's the outline. So these are two movies off Howard Berg's website. On the left, colloidal particles. On the right, bacteria. Firstly, notice half of these are stuck to the glass, so ignore those. These motions are different. They're both taking some kind of random walk. Here, a large number of very tiny steps. Here, you see the things moving in a pretty straight line for a certain distance and then suddenly changing direction. So that's called run and tumble motion. I won't go into great detail about what that looks like, but there's a model of it which has been established in the bacteria in the microbiology and mathematical biology literature for a long time. So here's your kind of random walk-like process. Each of these is one of these straight line swims, and they proceed at a pretty constant speed, something like 20 microns per second. And then once every second or so, but with an exponentially distributed interval, so there's a random process which makes you have one of these tumbles. So during the tumble, the bacteria actually literally tumbles around for reasons which I could explain but won't. And then it sets off swimming again. So in the simplest case, you assume that during this tumble, the swimming direction is completely randomized. Not quite true, but near enough. And also that the actual tumble event is quite small, short in duration compared to this the typical length of one of these runs, and therefore you tend to make an approximation where the tumble is instantaneous. So that is obviously a kind of random walk. I'll come back to that in a minute. There's a big literature on this, which goes back 20 years or more.
Considering that this case MSD going from T squared to T?
Yeah, sure. So you can work out the diffusion constant. Sorry, is there a question?
I want to know if it is a random walk or not.
Well, here's the process. So if you have a Poisson distributed length, random direction, it clearly is a random walk. The interesting case is when, well, on its own, yes. But wait till I just fill the rest of this slide out. That's the diffusion constant, okay? V squared alpha dimension of space. V is the swim speed, alpha is the rate of tumble events. It's non-Brownian. And that is interesting when these parameters, the swim speed and the tumble rate, depend on position. So when they depend on position, this is a very non-detailed balance process. Obviously, if there was just this process, you may as well think of it as reversible. So it's not reversible when these parameters, V and alpha, are position dependent, and therefore the diffusion constant is also position dependent. There's a process called chemotaxis, which is how bacteria find food. And the way they do that is they actually modulate the tumble rate according to the gradient of food density that they detect. So I'm not going to talk about chemotaxis, except that that is, for a long time, has thought to be implicated in the particular type of pattern I will describe later on. And I'll give you an explanation which doesn't actually depend on that. So this is a solvable problem, at least in one dimension. So in 1D, you can have two different velocities, left and right moving. You can give them different speeds. So here are two velocities. If you want, for generality, to account for these chemotaxis, for instance, you might have a different tumble rate for the left and right moving runs. And there's a certain particle density, which is sum of the right plus left moving. And there's a continuity equation in the absence of the birth and death processes, which I'll add at the end. So particles conserved, so the rate of change of the total density is the divergence of a certain current. And from this stochastic process, which is a kind of Bayes telegraph process, you can compute an expression for the current at large length and time scale. So if I look at the distances, much larger than the run length, and times much larger than 1 over alpha. So you get a current which is of the form of a diffusion equation with a drift in it. And both of these parameters, the diffusion constant, this is the gradient of the density, and the drift velocity, depend on these local run and tumble parameters, and they do so in a slightly surprising way. There's the expressions. I don't want to say anything more about the general case, but it's written down there. So if you look at the steady state solutions of this process, they have some interesting properties. Interesting, the first case I'm going to talk about is when the two swim speeds are the same and the two tumble rates are the same, but they both can vary with the position. So I have a symmetric process there. Solve those equations in steady state, and the steady state density is inversely proportional to V. So if you think of this as in terms of a diffusion process, remember D is V squared over alpha, this is a bit odd, because you've got a kinetic parameter, which is the speed, determining the steady state density. And that's, in fact, my proof that this is not a detailed balance process. It doesn't have an underlying, this is nothing to do with forces on the particles or a Boltzmann distribution for an energy, although I can obviously define an effective free energy for which that is the Boltzmann distribution. It is intuitive, though, if you are a normal person instead of a statistical mechanics freak, because this is just the same as you've got people walking down High Street and there's something interesting in the shop window, and they all slow down, and you'll find more people in front of the shop window than you will along the rest of the street. So that's okay. The asymmetric case I won't talk about, but we've done lots of work on sedimentation, putting bugs in traps and things like that, which come out of that case. So what I'm going to do now is make the bacteria interact with each other. In particular, the simplest case and an interesting one is when the speed depends on the local density of the bacteria. Exactly. If you have a spatially varying diffusion constant, of course you know the steady state is still flat. So it's crucial that it's not detailed balanced for the steady state to depend on the kinetic parameters rather than the underlying energy parameters. Okay. So this is an interesting case then, if I make the swim speed depend on the local density. So we know, I just told you, that particles will accumulate where they move slowly. So I could also imagine that they might move slowly where they accumulate. In other words, if I just decide that they're going to swim more slowly where they are numerous, which could be for steric reasons or it could be for other reasons, could be that they're signaling in some way and saying, slow down, there's lots of us. But if you did have a velocity which depended on the density, then you can see there's a feedback circuit here. And if I have a velocity which is a function of density like this, I can have phase separation. In other words, creation of domains of different coefficient densities purely because of this. And again, purely kinetics, nothing to do with interaction forces. Now, because this is in one dimension, you can map it onto a system with a free energy. It's interacting Brownian particles with a certain free energy which involves this function here. So if V is sufficiently steeply decreasing, you do get a bump in the free energy and you get a coexistence criterion, so a phase separation. And more generally, there's a spinodal instability here whenever the collective diffusion constant, which in the case of fixed alpha turns out to be this expression here, so negative within that zone of density there, whenever that's
negative. I'm trying to understand this free energy. Is the free energy that will give you steady state? That's how we define this?
Well, in a one-dimensional system of non-interacting particles, well, actually, no, in this one-dimensional system of interacting particles with V equals V of rho, it turns out that you can construct an effective free energy of which the steady state is the Boltzmann.
Right, and that's your definition of the free energy.
Yes. It's got nothing to do with forces between particles.
Yeah.
And the temperature of the room,
you have excluded volume?
Sorry?
There is no excluded volume between the particles.
No.
So the molecule.
Yeah. Okay. So this actually happens. That's phase separation. These are the coexisting densities. So just start with a bit of noise in initial conditions. This has actually got particles moving around with random tumble dynamics in one dimension. We've done this again and again, all kinds of, and the same happens in two and three dimensions. So this has undergone spinodal decomposition. It's now going to coarsen. And you can ask whether there's ultimately phase separation. In 1D, there still might be because it's a kinetic system, or whether this will coarsen to some large length with an interfacial density, a number of interfaces fixed by some kind of effective interfacial tension.
Is it obeying the coarsening of Paolo's predicted for?
Yeah, it is basically, it's just is the Kahn-Hilliard equation with negative diffusion constant. I mean, that's what you have when you look at those. Okay, so that's soft matter physics, but for bugs.
So there is no length scale?
There's no length scale.
For the
you know, in 1D you have, obviously in the Ising model, if you've got a finite interfacial energy, it will coarsen to a certain size and then stop. We haven't seen it stop. We don't know actually whether there is an interfacial energy because we can't take this mapping to the next order in the gradient expansion. So what we do know is that at zeroth order in the gradient expansion, it has to phase separate, but whether it will stop phase separating 1D is unknown at the moment. Okay. So now, get these bacteria and account for the fact that they can also breed. So there's a background story to this, which is that if you get an agar gel and you inoculate it with E. coli or salmonella or whatever, depending on the species, but in many cases the colony will grow. But then it will break into one of these strange patterns where you get concentric rings which then break into dots. And this was discovered in Berg's group in Harvard in the mid-90s and has been extensively looked at. And there are lots of complications here because I mentioned chemotaxis before, so that's this. You can bias your motion depending on gradients of a chemical. You can also secrete a chemical, and you can follow those. And this is one way in which bacteria can talk to each other. And up until now, the explanation of these patterns has involved this rather complicated stuff. So here's the standard model, which is in this book by Murray and was developed over a long period of time. It has between 7 and 12 adjustable parameters in it, depending on exactly which terms you keep. But you've got a density of cells. They're secreting a chemoattractant. There's also a food. The food modulates the cell reproduction rate and also the rate of producing chemoattractants, and runs out as the cells grow and everything diffuses, and there are all these parameters. But nonetheless, all of this is thought to be biologically, quotes, realistic and likely for this system. However, you might ask whether there's a simpler explanation. Is there a simpler explanation? Would I be standing here if not? Well, of course there is. All you need is you need to have particles that want to phase separate for whatever reason, and that have birth and death. In other words, if I put the, so what I have here, this is the birth and death equation with some kind of current. And what this does is it has a target density rho, and if the density is above rho, it dies off and comes back towards rho. And if it's below, it increases, it breeds up until it reaches rho. So with any kind of logistic term like this, you can only have one uniform phase, and that's rho equals rho zero. But if I put rho zero in the miscibility gap of a phase coexistence, then I cannot have a uniform phase because rho zero is unstable. In other words, this density here is going to split by phase separation into two phases. But these two phases cannot become bulk phases because they don't have density rho zero. So I can't have separated bulk phases except if they have rho zero, so I have a contradiction. So what happens if I have phase separation with a negative collective diffusion constant and some kind of interfacial tension and logistic growth? And the answer is those patterns. So if you do that just starting with the uniform initial condition with a bit of noise, you see microphase separation. And what is happening here is you've got these dense regions where the particles are generally dying off. In the interstitial regions here, they're breeding because the density is below, and they diffuse around and they come to these regions and they slow down and get stuck there, and then they die off. So this system is continually producing matter in the purple regions and killing it off in the yellow ones, and they are coupled together like that. Yes. So this is the same thing if you just start with it, as in the experiment, you start with an inoculum, you just put a blob in the middle of your agar gel, and lo and behold, you get these concentric ring patterns, and they start breaking into dots. So we say that whatever's going on with the rather complicated biochemistry in the systems, which may well have communication systems between bacteria, etc., that actually you should be thinking about equations like this. So spinodal decomposition, logistic growth. The reason why you have a negative diffusion constant, it could be the kind of interaction I mentioned with just a velocity that depends on density. It could also be something called quorum sensing, for instance, where bacteria secrete a chemical which tells them when they're numerous, and then they just slow down in response to that, which isn't the same necessarily as chemotaxis, where this chemical goes all over the place and they follow the gradients. But even if it was chemotaxis, I still think that that will give you a phase separation under the conditions I've described, and that this is the kind of description which, at least from a physics point of view, is a lot more helpful than the ones that I showed you before. Okay?
I can just out of curiosity, I mean, is breeding Galilean invariant in bacteria? I mean, we normally have to stop, but bacteria...
Is breeding Galilean invariant?
Well,
that's a great physics question.
I mean,
what do you mean?
We normally have to stop in order to breed.
Yes.
I mean, do bacteria?
That's a good question. I think they pause while they're dividing because they end up with flagelli on both ends as they're about to divide, and then they split. Yeah, so each individual will probably stop running and tumbling while it's subdividing. Yes, that should be added.
Do bears in this
How do you bury them?
Yeah, but they die, you just remove them.
They normally explode.
Huh?
They lice.
So they just dissolve?
Yeah. Running.
Okay, this is very beautiful, but I'm going back to the basic model that, let's say, you introduce a distance, a position-dependent diffusion coefficient and position-dependent velocity. Do people really know that you also don't have time-dependent velocity? Like, not related to position, like it slows down while it's going for some reason? Or
yeah, during the life cycle of the cell, for sure. I treat the velocities as all constant for each particle. They vary as well. But I think, you could introduce it. Most of the ways in which you can have time dependence of velocity are actually space dependence.
Okay, not that. That's what I mean.
Well,
it's really intrinsically time dependent. Like, he knows how much he traveled.
Yes. Well, the closest thing to that is chemotaxis, which I didn't talk about. Yes. So for chemotaxis, you have an onboard computer, and the way you work out which way to go, in fact, involves integrating over the concentration gradients you've seen. So there is time non-locality in that sense. But on a long time scale, that's just part of changing this tumble rate, so that the tumble rate becomes dependent on the local gradient of the food. So I don't. The longest memory in a bacterium for these kind of processes is about a second, which is the duration of one of these runs. But you could think of cases where there's other time dependence, I'm sure. Yeah.
In this case, the struggle decomposition occurs because of the conservation of the number of the bacteria.
Well, it occurs because you've got a negative collective diffusion cost. In other words, if there's a gradient, instead of flattening out, it increases. And that's all you need.
But you need also some conserved parameters.
Well, this is conserved. That's birth and death. So what I'm saying is that I have, in the absence of this term, I have got a process here which will lead to the phase separation. And on top of that, I put on a non-conservation of a particular type, which drives the density towards a specified fixed point, rho zero. So it's that combination that gives you the microphase separation rather than full phase separation.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay, so I will talk about some work on transition path in protein folding that I've been doing in recent years with a group of physicists from the University of Trento. So this is very much related to the work, to the experiments which were presented by Bill Eaton last week. So I remind you that proteins exist under two forms, the unfolded random coil, biologically inactive, whatever, and the folded or native state, which is believed to be globular, unique, etc. And of course, the big puzzle in all this is that the proteins have a conformational entropy, which is probably finite, and the number of globular states is exponentially large. So this is how protein looks. And the protein folding problem is really given a sequence of amino acid. What is the three-dimensional shape of the corresponding protein at atomic detail level? So what people do usually is they try a molecular dynamics. So when they try molecular dynamics, what they do, they have a parametrization of the energy of the force field of the protein. So there are all kinds of bonded terms which represent the geometry of the backbone. And then there is the Lennard-Jones 612, and this is the partial Coulomb, and this unit is in kilocalorie per mole. And then you use Newton or Langevin dynamics with some noise, and you just solve this equation forever until hoping to see some interesting events. And as you know, you don't see very much because it's very long, in fact. From if you compare the typical time step to be used to solve this equation, so originally the lowest time step that one should use is of the order of femtoseconds, but typically one can go up to hundreds of femtoseconds, 10 to the minus 13 seconds. And interesting time scale, so for the fastest folding protein, it's microseconds, but typical proteins of biological interest, the folding time is of the order of milliseconds to seconds. So that's many orders of magnitude, many particles, in particular if you add the solvent, which is what you should do. So this problem is a bit too complicated, so I've not been interested in this problem recently. And I've been more interested in a simpler problem, which is how do proteins fold? In other words, how do they go from the unfolded to the native state? So of course, in that case, you assume that the unfolded state is known, it's any state of the random coil, and the native state, you assume that it is known, you have it experimentally from the PDB, so you have the crystal structure or the NMR structure, so you have the position of all the atoms. So first of all, just a note, as you know, when you take a protein and you add some denaturant, so the denaturant can be urea, whatever you want, or it can be also temperature. This is the fraction of native protein, and if you look in a certain denaturant condition, you have a certain fraction of the protein which is native, the other fraction which is denatured, which means that in your population of proteins, certain proteins are folded, certain are unfolded, but if you look on a given one individual protein, what happens is that as a function of time, the protein spends some time in the folded state, and then sometime it tunnels to the unfolded state, and it keeps doing that spontaneously. It's part of the temperature fluctuations in such a way that the ratio of the native to unfolded precisely gives you these denaturation curves. And of course, since it's a finite system, these intervals are finite. There is no real phase transition. The tunneling is finite. The barriers are finite. So this is typical trajectories of molecular dynamics if you would run them for long enough. So the folding pathway problem is essentially you have a protein which goes from state A to state B, you know A and B, and the question is which pathway or families of pathways that the protein take to go from A to B. And as I said, it is motivated by single molecule experiment, where people look at the spontaneous thermal transitions from denatured to native. So this is the experiments that Bill was doing, but it can be also used to see allosteric transition between two metastable or two native different native states of the same protein. So the theoretical framework that I use is the Langevin dynamics. So you assume, so I do everything in 1D, but of course you have to imagine that you do it for all degrees of freedom and of the protein. So you have a Langevin equation, which is Newton plus friction. And in fact, you can show that if you go at time scales, which are larger than some threshold, which is typically tens of picoseconds, you can use overdamped dynamics, Brownian dynamics, which has this standard form, where this is the force deriving from the potential U. So U is the sum of all the two-body potentials. And the Gaussian noise satisfies itself that you have detailed balance when you have this. So this Langevin equation is equivalent to a Fokker-Planck equation for the probability distribution to find a particle at point x at time t, given that you started at xi, so xi at time 0 is, for instance, the initial condition, so it's a protein in a denatured state or something like that. And what you do is you transform this Fokker-Planck equation into, by this standard transformation, which is well known, you can transform it into a Schrödinger equation. And this, so by multiplying by the square root of the Boltzmann weight, essentially, you go to a Schrödinger equation where the Hamiltonian of this Schrödinger equation is a funny kind of quantum Hamiltonian. I call it quantum because it's a Schrödinger-like equation, where you have a Laplacian term and you have two terms which involve the square of the gradient of U and the Laplacian. And as a consequence, if you look at the probability to go from initial state to final state, using quantum mechanical notations, you have this prefactor which comes from the simple transformation that was here, and then you have this matrix element of this evolution operator with this Hamiltonian.
Henri, does it only work in one dimension?
No, no, it's in any dimension. That there is nothing, that's what I was saying. This X is generic of any dimension. So then one has to look exactly what means gradient U square. It's in fact a sum over all degrees of freedom of the gradient pi. And this is just the Laplace, the multidimensional Laplacian. It can be easily generalized to any dimension. So then the idea is to write, so to use the Feynman path integral to represent this matrix element of the evolution operator. So you can write it as an integral over all paths which start at xi and end at xf with a certain action like this, and the effective action is given here. And this expression at this level is completely exact. There is no approximation. This gives you the probability for a particle to start. So I say particle, but it's a complex system to start at xi at time ti and end at xf at time tf. And the effective potential, as I said, is given by that. So now, how does one calculate this? So the difference, of course, is that if you do standard molecular dynamics, you do your dynamics, and you wait, because your system is trapped in a minimum, and nothing happens forever. And once in a while, if you are lucky, you will see a transition. But usually, you are not lucky, because the probability to see such a transition is very small. And so it's very long. So whereas when you do like this, you impose to see a transition between xi and xf. So you select only the path which will make a transition between xi and xf during this time interval. So of course, it's quite a different approach from the other. So the idea that we had was to calculate and to approximate this this probability by a semi-classical method, in other words, by looking at the minimum action, so that this will give the highest weight to the probability distribution. So essentially, what one does, so it's related to the so-called WKB approximation. So one looks for the saddle point of this action, which is here. So this saddle point is a classical equation of motion in the inverted potential. So for those of you who know instanton theory in quantum mechanics or so, it's really exactly the same. So you're bound to solve. So the reason you have a minus is because here you have the Hamiltonian and not in the action you have the Hamiltonian and not the Lagrangian. So you have this equation of motion with the boundary conditions. And then what you do is you have to solve this equation for xi, xf. So instead of solving this equation, which is a bit difficult because you have these two boundary conditions, what one does, one goes into, so okay, these are representation of the effective potential. So instead of staying in Newtonian dynamics, you know that Newtonian dynamics is equivalent to Hamiltonian Jacobi dynamics. So the advantage of Hamilton-Jacobi is that you have fixed ends. So essentially, you can replace this effective action for the minimum by this expression, which is the Hamilton-Jacobi. And then what you have to do is minimize over all. So you have paths which start at point xi and which go to xf. So you have any path like this. And you have to find that you compute the action along the path according to this formula. And you have to minimize this action along the path. So that will give you the trajectory which is done by the particle, by the system going from native to denatured also. And so this is an energy formalism, and the total time along the trajectory is given by this integral. So this has been applied, so we have done many calculations. We can include fluctuations, and I just show you a movie. So there was a calculation by D.E. Shaw on this fragment of protein. And so this is a, and they find that there is one dominant path. In other words, in all their runs, they see that the protein always folds according to the same, they solve the standard molecular dynamics equation, and they see that the protein folds always through the same pathway, let's say.
And the choice of degrees of freedom is just Cartesian coordinates.
Yes, it's an all-atom simulation. This one is all-atom.
But Cartesian coordinates.
Yes, yes, we do Cartesian coordinate. Yes, yes. That's the one which makes sense if you think that the Langevin equation is some limit of the molecular dynamics for high friction.
What you do about the bonds?
The bonds can fluctuate. The bonds are not fixed. They have very high rigidity, but the bonds are not rigid. They are harmonic bonds.
If they are very rigid, then they exchange energy very slowly with the environment.
Yes.
How do you choose the final? How do you choose the final configuration?
So the final state, I take out from the PDB, the crystal structure of the protein. So that's the native state. I'm not predicting the final state. I assume that the final state is known, and the initial state you generate by doing molecular dynamics at very high temperature. So, for instance, you do molecular dynamics at 1,000 degrees. So the protein will unfold. Then you thermalize it at 300 Ks for a little while so that it will be unfolded, so that you will have a generic configuration of denatured protein at 300 K, and that's your initial state.
And potential you take from where?
Sorry?
And potential you?
So potential we take from all the people who are very clever and who have...
How different is the new simulation from there?
They solve Langevin or molecular dynamics as a function of time, and they wait so they can do millisecond simulations. Here you just simulate really, and as Bill told us, that the transition time is of the order of it's a tenth of a microsecond. So if you have constrained your system to start here and end here, right, you don't need to simulate. You see, the problem is that when you have protein folding, it's like a double well. You have a very long waiting time here where nothing happens, and then you are waiting that you will have a set of favorable noise configuration which will take you above here and bring you there. And this waiting time, which is the Cramer's time, actually, so let me show you the picture because I come back to that in a minute. Okay. So this is just to illustrate. I mean, since there is nothing, there is no experimental whatever for the moment of this, so this is the way, it's just to show you that you can do it.
So this is an all-atom simulation?
Yes, with implicit solvent.
Implicit solvent, and when you do Langevin, how do you pick the friction coefficients? Because if it's all-atom, you have to worry about what they do with the hydrogen atom, for example.
Yes, okay, but... the point is that, of course, the friction coefficient is it's a time scale, so I don't know what they take, to tell you the truth.
You just say what I'm getting at is that, you know, if I think about OH stretch, it's not overdamped in the real world, right? Because I can. So do you just say that each atom feels the same friction coefficient or doesn't scale with something?
That's a good question. I will ask... my collaborators. This is they do the simulation at a microscopic detail. I have a more mesoscopic view. So anyway, so in the five last minutes, I would like to show. So this method that I exposed has a few disadvantages, and the main disadvantage is that you have to look for this dominant path between the two states. First of all, there may be many such paths you don't know in advance. And once you find one by this minimizing the Hamilton-Jacobi method, so what we do is we do some kind of simulated annealing to try to find other ones. But usually what you find is you find other paths which are very near this one. So you don't really sample the whole space of path. So this is again this picture. So you spend your life waiting in the unfolded state, and suddenly you go to the other side. So you have two time scales. One is the folding time, which is exponential in the barrier height, and the other one, which has been shown to be logarithmic, essentially, in the barrier time. So this one is very, very small compared to this one. This one is typically seconds, and this can be microseconds. So the method I want to talk in the last few minutes is a new method to generate transition path, which I published just recently. So the idea is to, so in fact, it's something mathematicians have derived more or less up to a certain point using martingale theory and Girzanov theorem. I don't know if you know in probability. But essentially, so the problem is the following. Imagine you have a particle which starts at x0 at time 0 and ends at xf at time tf. Given this condition, what is the probability to find a particle at point x at time t? So it's the conditional probability for a path to be at xt given that it starts at x0, 0, xf, tf. So then it's very easy, especially when you know polymer theory. This conditional probability is just the product of the probability for the particle to go from 0, x0 to xt, times the probability to go from xt to xftf. So it's just the product of these two probabilities, probability from x0, x, xf, xt. No, that's just, forget path integral, it's just probability. That's just a matter of probability. So then you know that P satisfies, P, which is this probability, satisfies the Fokker-Planck equation, and Q, which is here, satisfies the so-called adjoint or reversed Fokker-Planck equation. So these are the direct Fokker-Planck adjoint. And then you see, by using these two equations, you see that the conditional probability satisfies this modified Fokker-Planck equation, which is exact, which is the same as the original Fokker-Planck equation, except that the potential is beta u minus 2 log q. And q, I remind you, is this probability to go from xt to xftf. So it's an equation which is, of course, non-causal, because this depends on the future. And of course, this quantity, you don't know really how to calculate it. But then, so this is the if you have this modified Langevin equation, you conclude that this modified Langevin equation comes from a modified, this is a modified Fokker-Planck. So this modified Fokker-Planck comes from a modified Langevin equation, and the modified Langevin equation is here. So instead of u as the force, you have u minus 2 log q for the potential. So there is this additional force, and this force, which is given by this, is the one which forces the particle to end at the target point xf at time tf. Okay, so there is some other manipulation. Now, the difficulty is, of course, how do you compute?
Is it going to go to minus minus infinity the xf, or some divergence that it will really force you to go to?
So the potential which is generated by this is indeed a potential which becomes infinite at xf, tf, but it goes in the right way so that you don't bias the weights of the trajectories. And if now h, the Hamiltonian, if you remember, there is a diffusion term and there is a potential term. This is the funny quantum kind of potential term. Now, as I said, the transition time across the barrier is very short compared to the waiting time. So if the time is short, and the time which enters in this modified Langevin equation, if this time is short enough, so if the whole process is short compared to most of the timescales in the problem, you can use the Strotter formula, which is used in quantum mechanics, which tells you that e to the minus ht can be written like this, and the correction term is of order t cube. So if you collect all this and put it back into place, you get a modified Langevin equation, which I call the Langevin bridge equation. So it's dx dt. So this is the source term which forces the particle to go to the target. So you see that when t goes to tf, it diverges, except if x goes to xf. So this term really drives the particle at the right place. And the potential which enters in this modified equation is not gradient u. It is time dependent, and it involves v, the quantum potential, and the noise is the same. So this equation is to be compared with the original Langevin equation. Okay. So this, of course, this equation is exact for pure Brownian motion. If there is no potential, this equation, this modified Langevin equation, is an exact equation which gives you the conditional probability, all the conditional path, condition Brownian path, which starts at a point and ends at another point. Okay, so you can do rescaling if, okay, I don't want to. And so if you look at the example of the double well, so this is just a standard Langevin equation. You see with there are 1,000 time steps, and you see that over one, so that's a real simulation. That's a 1D quartic potential. It's a bit trivial, but that's how good I am in numerics. And when you enlarge it, you see that the transition time is, in fact, if you calculate the mean crossing time, is of the order of 3.6. Now, if you solve my equation, the modified equation, you have to choose TF, the final, the total folding time. So let me show you how it looks. So first of all, let me show you some trajectory. So in red, in black are the real trajectories obtained by solving the exact modified Langevin equation, which is this. So this exact modified, in the case of 1D, you can calculate exactly Q by diagonalizing the Hamiltonian. And so you can solve exactly the true modified equation. Okay, and this is a comparison of some trajectories. So the black one are the true one, and the red are the approximate when you do this short time approximation.
So do I understand correctly? So in your method, you have to specify the duration.
Yes. The transition time. Okay. So that's an important point. The transition time is distributed. Right. It's a distributed time. So what you have is that it's distributed, but it's fairly narrow.
Right.
So if you, for instance, in this case, it's 3.6. So if I take a time which is substantially larger than 3.6, what I will have first a waiting period, and then the particle will, this is exact. So here you can see that you have a period where the particle stays close to one, and then it goes.
Right.
Same here. So here, it's a different, okay, so the agreement is not very good. Now, if you take a very long time, so this is one of the real trajectories. Of course, when you solve exactly the Langevin equation, the transition can take place at any time between the two, whereas my approximate equation is valid only for short times, so it will necessarily put the transition at the end of the time.
Yeah.
But what is important is, so all this might be wrong, but at the time when you start to have the transition, the equation is quite...
But the reason I asked it is because one interesting question, so experimentally, is what's the distribution
of course, yes. Okay, so you can generate many trajectories because, given the time, I will stop here. I just want to say that the method is completely parallelizable. So what you can do is you can generate thousands of such trajectories. They are all strictly independent. They are not correlated. So you have if you take 1,000 trajectories, you will have 1,000 samples of the transition time. Then the definition of transition time, that's your business. You decide that you define whatever you want, another parameter or whatever. And then you can just do a histogram. So that's one of the great advantages. The trajectories are independent. You can reweight them. I didn't talk about that. And you can use each of these trajectories also if you want to do afterwards either transition path sampling by Monte Carlo, because you have a population of initial states, or dominant folding path, as I saw. And you can work, and the advantage of this method is that you can work with explicit solvent, which you cannot do in the previous method that I showed before. Okay, and voila. Okay, thanks. Sorry?
Ali, people do simulation of activated processes like nucleation of droplets like Dan Frankel. They, I think, apply a method called transition fed sampling, which was developed by Chandler.
Absolutely.
What is the relation?
So the thing of Chandler is essentially when you, so at this level, at this level, in this framework, at this level, that would amount to try to sample this exponential distribution. That is transition path sampling. So you try to generate any path which connects the two, and then you deform your path and accept and reject according to this thing. So what we do in this first approach is we look for the minimum path by doing, it's a, like a saddle point approximation to try to find what is
so
the
that's the Chandler method, just to
know. Sorry?
That would be the Chandler
method. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Chandler and all the variants of that.
Well, it's not Dan Frankel actually uses forward flux sampling, which is a bit different. You find your way up this potential in stages.
Yes, but it's essentially,
Well, it's very fast, actually. It is efficient.
Well, but for instance, for protein folding, all this doesn't. All these methods are. So, and of course, the method, the last method that I showed is completely different because it's.
Okay, thank you very much, Shura, for the invitation. I'm Everett Lippmann. I live over in Broida Hall over there where they keep the rest of the experimentalists. And I'm going to tell you today about single molecule experiments that we do using polymers as instrumentation. And the work I'm going to tell you about was mostly done by my former student, Charles Wickersham, who's now at Berkeley. Okay, so I'll start out by telling you about inkjet printers, which maybe you didn't expect. We experimentalists like devices that are very precise, and it turns out that inkjet printers are extremely precise, especially when you consider that they only cost about $100. So if you think about, you take your drawing program and you make a vertical line, and then you print this out on a piece of paper, if you have a nice inkjet printer, you're going to see a straight line come out. And in order for the printer to do that, it needs to be able to locate a dot on that page to within about 40 microns, and the span is 8.5 inches, and that works out to be about better than a part in 5,000 accuracy for a pretty cheap device. And the way it does this is by using a device called an optical encoder. And so this plastic strip here, if you magnify it, has a bunch of stripes on it, and you can see there's a belt that drives this carriage back and forth. This is the inkjet cartridges going here. And this plastic strip with the stripes on it, this is a millimeter scale, by the way, the stripes are about 6 per millimeter, and they get dragged back and forth through this little device here. And inside that, there's an LED, and there's a sensor on the other side of the plastic strip. So it gets dragged back and forth, and the strip is between it. And so as the stripes go between the LED and the sensor, you get this periodic signal that comes out of the sensor. And by counting the cycles of that periodic signal, you can see how far the carriage moves, and that's how the inkjet printer locates the carriage. Now, it also has to know which direction the carriage is moving, because it needs to know whether the cycle meant it went right or left. And the way it does this is either by having a set of slightly staggered windows so that you get two out-of-phase signals, and the other way that you can arrange that is you can have just one set of stripes, like on the encoder that I showed you, and you have a pair of LEDs and a pair of sensors that are staggered by 90 degrees, and then if the phase shift is one way, you know the carriage is moving left, If the phase shift is the other way, you know the carriage is moving right. So as with many different measurement techniques, having a periodic signal is the gold standard if you want to do precision measurements. And so what we've done is we've taken this plastic strip, which is a polymer, and we've shrunk it down to a single molecule of a polymer, and we use DNA to do this. And the basic idea is that we take a piece of DNA and we're going to put fluorescent dyes on it in a periodic series. And we're going to use single molecule FRET in order to read out the signal. And I don't have time to tell you all about single molecule FRET, but fortunately all you have to know about it is we use a laser, we excite the green dye, which we've attached to a molecular motor. If the green dye is less than 5 nanometers from an acceptor dye, which is orange or red, then you get orange or red light out. If it's more than 5 nanometers from the acceptor dyes, you'll get green light out. That's all you really need to know. So as this molecular motor moves down the DNA, the green donor dye gets close to the red and orange acceptor dyes, and you will expect to see more signal when it's close by. Okay, so the big question is, how do we make this thing? So this is how we make it. So this is a schematic picture of a double-stranded DNA molecule that we assemble from little pieces that we can actually just buy from a company. And we design the little pieces to have complementary sequences. So the same color means the sequence is complementary, and you see we've labeled, for example, lowercase b is complementary to uppercase b and so forth. And so what we do is we order these 12 pieces, and we order one of them having an acceptor dye on it. So this one labeled Z has an acceptor dye on it. And we throw this in the soup, we heat it up and we cool it down, and what happens is these pieces all find their complements and they assemble themselves, and then we put in this enzyme called a ligase, and the ligase goes along the DNA backbone and just patches up all the nicks. And so when we're finished, we get this nice construct of double-stranded DNA, and in this particular experiment, we had one acceptor dye every 69 base pairs on the DNA. Okay, so we need a molecular motor to put on this thing to study, and we decided to look at a helicase called DNAB. It's from E. coli. The reason it's called DNAB is because they catalog proteins that were involved in DNA replication. The first one was DNAA and the second one was DNAB. So there's nothing profound about that name. It's a hexamer, and what its job is it rides ahead of this whole machinery that replicates the DNA, and it just pulls the two strands apart. That's what this helicase does. And it turns out that if you put the helicase on a suitable piece of DNA and you give it ATP, it will go all by itself even if it doesn't have all of this machinery behind it. Okay? Helicases are important. This is just an example of a disease that happens if you have a mutation in a particular helicase that's involved in DNA repair. And you can see what happens to a person who has that syndrome at age 56. This lady looked like that at age 48. That's what happened. So helicases are actually quite important. Okay, so here's a diagram of the experiment that we did. So we take a piece of DNA, we've assembled it like I showed you before with these acceptor dyes. We chose a spacing of 69 base pairs. You remember when I told you about FRET that the critical distance is about 5 nanometers. If the dyes are closer than 5, you get red light. If they're farther than 5, you get green light. And so we designed this to be about 4 times that critical distance, so that if the green dye is halfway in between here, you get no red signal, okay? And you'll see why that's important in a second. So what we did is we took the green dye, we attached it to the helicase, and then we allowed it to start unwinding this DNA by giving it ATP and letting it go. Okay, and this is the signal we ended up with. And so once again, this is a single molecule experiment. So this is a signal coming from only one copy of the helicase moving up one single piece of DNA that we've isolated. And now you can take a second to look at what this gives you. So there are a couple things that you can notice that immediately you know that each peak happens when this green dye is next to one of the red dyes, because that's when you get the red light. So this, all we're looking at here is the acceptor light, which is the red light coming out of the red fluorophore. So by knowing this spacing, you can look at the time scale, you can immediately see how fast it's going. Okay, and it turns out that this one was going about 450 base pairs per second. Another thing that you can see, which may not strike you as that interesting if you don't know much about motors, but you can see how far it went, or in this case, you can you have a lower bound on how far it went. And that's called the processivity when you're talking about molecular motors. And this is actually something that people don't really understand that well about how this particular helicase behaves when it's working by itself. In fact, there is a very widely cited paper that says that the processivity of this particular helicase is 10 base pairs, meaning it would unwind 10 base pairs and then it would fall off and another one would come along and replace it. But as you can see, we don't have any jumps in the phase of this signal. It's not a beautiful signal, but we don't have any jumps in the phase. If you look at this overlay of the fundamental frequency that we get just by taking the Fourier transform and looking at the first component, you can see it's very, very steady, and there are no instances of any sort of signal looking like this. So we think that actually this is one molecule that went 345 base pairs, even though sort of the prevailing idea was that this thing only has a 10 base pair processivity. And so by looking at one at a time, we've actually learned that probably that's incorrect. Another nice thing about this is that as single molecule experiments go, we have extremely high resolution. And when you consider resolution, when you're tracking a motor or in a lot of other cases, you have to consider both the time and the spatial resolution. So you can get very high spatial resolution if you take 5 seconds, for example, to integrate the light. But in our case, each of these little bins that we counted up photons in is about 10 milliseconds wide. And you can see that you see these jumps in 10 milliseconds that are clearly above the noise level. And it turns out that the average distance that is traveled by the motor in one of these bins is a nanometer and a half. And so as the motor travels, especially on these rising and falling edges here, as the motor travels a nanometer and a half, we can see a very distinct signal above the noise in 10 milliseconds, which is extremely high combination of time and spatial resolution. So we're hoping to actually learn more about the mechanism of how these motors chug along. Okay, so maybe I'll pause here and ask if there are any questions about what I've said so far.
What is the going up and down in the signal within each of the peaks, from the big peaks?
Okay, so every time the green dye is next to one of the red dyes, you get light. And the closer they are, the more red light you get. And so we're looking only at the red light that you get from that. So when the green dye is halfway in between, that's when you're down here.
Yeah.
When the green, okay. Oh, the small ones, okay.
Is there precession around?
There is precession around.
Is there a response to this oscillation of resonation peak?
Probably not. It's too fast. So there are a couple answers to that question. One answer is yes, the overall, this is not a straight piece of DNA with ladder rungs. It's a very complicated geometry, and this protein is actually a very complicated looking thing. And if you actually do the modeling with the actual crystal structures, what you see is that yes, you have these, the signal you expect goes up and down much faster than we can actually resolve, because we just don't get enough photons to resolve that. So part of this fluctuation, for example, this you see sort of like two peaks here.
Yeah.
This is much larger than the shot noise, which is the other thing that causes it to go up and down. So we have a finite number of counts here, so 30 counts, so you expect the square root of 30 fluctuations. Okay, so that sort of sets the scale for what we can really call real. So if you see a fluctuation here that's bigger than the square root of this number, it's probably something real. So something like this here is probably caused by the fact that as this protein tracks the DNA helix, you get situations where, for example, the donor dye will make actually two passes by the acceptor dye before it moves on to that region where it doesn't have an acceptor nearby. And we're actually doing some very detailed modeling of that now.
How long is a piece of DNA extracted?
The part with the dyes on it is only about five times this distance. But what we did is we put a 16 micron long tether on it, because we use a magnetic bead to hold it up off the glass, and we have to get the bead out of the laser. So
it's nothing to do with processivity, it's just the size of your stuff?
No.
So this construct, I've only shown four dyes here, but this data is from a construct with five dyes on it. The dyes are spaced by 69 base pairs, right? And so if you see five peaks and the phase is continual, then you can say that it's gone about five times 69 base pairs. So it's gone about 345 base pairs.
The question continually.
But you have more dyes there afterwards.
Okay, let me go on. because
you mentioned something about processivity, but
yeah, this is a lower bound. This is a lower bound on the processivity. Okay, but let me go on because that's the next thing I'm going to talk about. Okay. Why don't we have what?
Tell it something, but if you listen as far as you're saying, when you're more than R0, you have a signal.
Right.
So why isn't the dead zone in between the peaks?
Okay, well, so the, I mean,
it's exponential.
What you get is you get the energy transfer efficiency versus R looks like this, okay? And so this is 5 nanometers.
And the 10 is still something you can see.
Yeah, I mean, when you're really 2 R not here, then you really get 0. Okay, but you still see something here. And the other thing is, yeah, so these, we're not expecting this, again, this is just the fundamental frequency. We're not expecting this signal to look like a sine wave because this is very flat here. So as soon as it gets a little bit closer than R naught, you get essentially full transfer here. So as this thing moves along, you expect to see a jump up, and then it stays, and then it down, and then jumps up again.
And in terms of R0, 69 base pairs is what? It's twice?
Or it's 23 nanometers, and R0 is about 5 or 6 nanometers. Yeah. So,
and also, it looks like integral of peak decay. If something happens to die, somebody kind of gets destroyed, you know. Fourth and fifth peaks are smaller.
We can't really say anything for sure about that. I mean, it's different dyes, so they're different dye. Each time it's a different dye, and they're individual dyes, so they aren't bleaching. I mean, if they bleach, you see nothing. And in fact, we do have some events where you see peak, nothing, peak, 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 because the second one bleached. So in this case, it's one dye. We can't really say anything in this event about that. Okay, so clearly you recognize that it's a weakness of this experiment that we only had 5 dyes. And that's an artifact of this scheme that I showed you for assembly before. Every time we want to put on a new dye, we need another unique sequence to put on there. Our yield goes down, it becomes more expensive. And so we started thinking about ways to make much longer constructs with many, many more dyes on them. Okay, and so I'm going to shift gears and tell you actually about a different experiment now, because we haven't actually run the helicase. For technical reasons, the helicase is very difficult to work with. We haven't actually run the helicase on a long encoder yet, but this leads into the next one. So what you can do is this thing called rolling circle DNA replication in order to make a much longer construct. So what you do is you design a sequence, and then you make a primer that's complementary to the ends of the sequence. You throw them together, and the primer makes this into a circle. You use that ligase enzyme again, and you close up the circle. And now you have this primer sitting on a closed circle of DNA. Then what you do is you bring in this thing called DNA polymerase, and this is from this thing called a bacteriophage, which has a name Phi-29. And so the Phi-29 DNA polymerase, its job is to replicate DNA, and what it does is it reads the template here, and it just puts in the complementary nucleotides around the side as it goes along. And so it goes around the circle here, and it has this thing called strand displacement activity. And what that means is that when it gets back to this side, if there's something here where it's supposed to put the new nucleotides, it just boots it off. And so what it does is it just keeps going around and around and around, and as it's doing that, it just pushes what it already did out of the way, and you get this big, long piece of single-stranded DNA with many, many, many repeats of the sequence you designed. Okay, then you just anneal with a complement, and you ligate again, and you can get this very long thing with 200 or so dyes on it. So now I'm leading into the next experiment. So we actually got very interested in this enzyme because it's much easier to work with than the helicase. And so we decided we were going to do an experiment just to track this particular polymerase. And what we do is we're going to take advantage of the strand displacement activity to do this. And now we're going to do an experiment where you don't even need FRET, okay? So here's the next way we decided to make an encoder. So here we used polymerization to make the encoder. So before we had a unique sequence in each position. Now what we do is we take two sequences where the end of one is complementary to the beginning of the next one. And we can put this in the soup, and then you get a distribution of lengths because you have no control anymore over the length of your construct because it just keeps tacking on it as long as it wants. But you can put those in an electrophoresis gel and separate them out, and then you cut out a piece of the gel and you get the one of the length that you want. What we did with this one is we ordered them from the company with no phosphate group on this, on the 5' end of these oligonucleotides. And what that does is it prevents the ligase from closing up this side of the backbone. So after we anneal these things, we ligate, and this side of the backbone gets closed up, this side does not. And so what you have is just a bunch of dilabeled oligos that are unconnected, but they're annealed in their correct place. And we leave a little gap here for the polymerase to load. Okay, then what we do is this experiment where we tie down this construct I just described to you. Now we can take the polymerase with no dye on it whatsoever, so it's really in its kind of, in the way it's supposed to be. The polymerase unmodified comes in and it starts replicating. And what it does is every time it displaces one of these guys, since they're not attached, it just gets kicked off. And it only takes about 1 millisecond for it to diffuse out of the laser focus. And so what happens is if you shine a red laser on this thing, so no more blue laser, no more FRET, you just shine a red laser on the red dyes, you get a red fluorescence signal out, and every time one of these guys gets boots off, you get a step down in your signal. Okay? And so now we can look at our signal and we can say we know how fast this thing is going. Okay? And no FRET required. The thing that we lose, of course, is that FRET has very high spatial resolution. And now our spatial resolution is the size of these oligos, which is more like 63 base pairs or something. So we lose the resolution, but we have the advantage that we can actually watch the enzyme, unmodified enzyme, single molecule working on an unmodified substrate, which is unique to single molecule experiments as far as I know. So we've gotten a bunch of different traces, and we've learned a lot about the replication rate of this enzyme. So Schwartz and Quake did an experiment where they had a hairpin, and they replicated through the hairpin to measure the speed of this polymerase, but they were limited to 50 base pairs per second by the frame rate of their camera. And so we have no such limitation, and so although our data sort of qualitatively agree with theirs, at the low speed end we see much higher speeds than they saw. And the Bustamante group in Berkeley did a force measurement of the same polymerase, and they got about the same average speed we got, but they saw much smaller dispersion in the speeds. Okay, so this is sort of a technical thing if you are interested in our possible signal-to-noise ratio. So people ask me, how many dyes can you use in this sort of scheme? And it turns out that if you just go through some fairly simple math, you can find that our signal-to-noise ratio is given by this expression, where that's our integration time, and that's the number of dyes. And so, for example, here you have a 40 millisecond integration time. You multiply by 2.5, that's 100. If you have 4 dyes, then you have 25 under the square root, and your signal to noise is about 5. And if you look at this, that looks like about a signal to noise of about 5. So what we can do is we can increase the number of dyes so we can follow it for a longer period of time, but because of the shot noise, we're going to get lower resolution. Okay, so we're actually very excited about this technique because there are lots of possibilities for getting much more complicated and interesting signals out of this polymer instrumentation by, for example, putting 2 colors of dyes on there and staggering them so that you get this nice phase relationship that would tell you for sure that you're not seeing, for example, photobleaching events. And we could also, you know, design very complicated templates for the rolling circle replication that would allow us to study the sequence dependence of the enzyme's motion and things like that. So these are the guys who've worked with me. Charlie was the graduate student who did all this work, and Daniel is an undergraduate who helped us with the synthesis of the polymerizing encoders. Thank you. We actually don't put the for the second experiment, we didn't put it under tension. And in fact, in the first experiment, the only reason we used a magnetic bead is just to keep it up off the glass. And so, I mean, our philosophy is we would like to see how it works in nature, and so why would we put it under tension? But, of course, the force people use the tension to actually monitor where it is. And so if you look at the Bustamante paper, what they see is that if you put it under tension, it slows down.
But how do you change ATP, concentration of ATP?
You know, we wanted to do that, but it turns out that helicase, there's a problem with that helicase. It's a hexamer. I don't know if you noticed in the picture. It has it has 6 units. And the problem with that is that, see, it has these 6 units. You put the monomer in solution. It has to assemble on the DNA and start going. In order to do that, it needs a certain concentration to assemble efficiently. And the problem is that concentration is much, much higher than the concentration of labeled monomers that you want in your solution to do a single molecule experiment. So if we were to use the optimal concentration to get it to assemble and go repeated reliably, we would have much too much noise in our experiment from the dye-labeled monomers that we're using. So some of these monomers have to have the dyes on them here so that we get the signal. And even one out of every six of them, if you put it at nanomolar concentration, will give you just way too much noise back into the system to do the single molecule experiment. So we had to do the experiment at a much lower concentration of these monomers than is optimal. And so it took hours and hours and sometimes days to get a single event.
For the other method, you don't need that.
For the other one, we don't need that, no. Right, so for this experiment, we can't, it was unreliable. And so we wanted to try modulating the ATP concentration, but it was too hard to get it to give us signal. I mean, in fact, just to give you an example, the first time Charlie got data was April of 2008, first periodic signal he saw. The second periodic signal he saw was August of 2008. And so it was a very difficult thing. In the other experiment, it gets its energy from the nucleotides that it's adding to the DNA. And so we could actually, for example, starve it of one nucleotide and see, you know, watch it chunk along until it gets to the right place and then it would pause. But we haven't done that yet. So. That's right, yeah.
What about the sequence dependence? Is it possible to change GC-rich regions, PT-rich regions?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, with these techniques, we can synthesize any sequence we want.
So what would you expect to see for the velocity of accessibility on the sequence?
Well, I guess naively, I would expect to see it slow down if it was lots of GCs because it's a little harder to pull apart. But actually, people don't know yet whether or not the helicase is active in the sense that it yanks the two things apart, or whether it's passive in the sense it waits for a thermal fluctuation and sort of ratchets forward. So it's an interesting question, and it's something, if we get a more reliable helicase that doesn't need this high concentration to assemble, we might start looking at that. Okay?
Okay.